welcome to Inside the Cylinder. We are your official Detroit Pistons show here via Almighty Baller, and we're now a part of Dash Radio. We're super excited to be bringing you the best Pistons coverage on the airwaves. If you're new to the show, I'm David Fernandez. I'm a writer for DetroitBadBoys.com, the SB Nation affiliate for the Detroit Pistons. And I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Joey Mack.
Hey, guys. Very excited to talk some Pistons basketball here on the show. Again, my name is Joey Mack. I'm not a writer. I'm just bringing content on the show. So, excited to talk some Pistons basketball.
Definitely. And if you are new listener here via Dash Radio, we have been covering the Pistons for quite some time now. This is our first season running with Inside the Cylinder, and it's been a tumultuous season, up and down. Obviously, right now, unfortunately, not in the playoffs, but plenty of stuff to be talking about as we head towards the off season. So let's just get into it. Let's just hop right on into some of these off season topics, Joe.
Yeah, let's do it. Clearly, the Pistons did not make the playoffs this year, so we are in off season mode. So I guess we'll dive into a couple of those topics in terms of some moves and some adjustments that we're going to make here. I think the two main things really at this point in time are whether or not we should max KCP, and then the one guy player on this team that might be leaving is Aaron Baines. So those are two realistic potential moves that might be made. So the Pistons did come out and say that they're willing to match any KCP offer. David, thoughts on that?
I kind of had a couple of thoughts on that. So first and foremost, I'm trying to understand the tactic in saying that. So it was reported recently that, obviously KCP, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, has a contract coming up. He is going to be off that second deal and finally entering his first year of starting to get that real money. And for KCP, it's extremely real money. It's going to be a contract north of $120 million, $110 million. It's going to be like a $10 million or $20 million plus year deal. So, Joe, I guess there's kind of two ways to see this. It could be you're kind of throwing that out there to say, hey, teams, do what you want to do. We're going to re-sign this guy at all cost. Or B, and by doing that, maybe being trying to set that as like a deterrent, like you might as well not even chase after him because we're going to re-sign him anyways. Or the flip side of that is, if you're a team and you're not necessarily even serious about signing Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, you could just throw out a lot of money and say, this is what we're going to offer you. And just knowing that Detroit is probably going to match at that point, just to get extra money out of Detroit's pockets. Did you think that at all? Why are we showing our cards?
That's a good point. And I think throughout this entire period, everyone had the mindset that the Pistons would match any offer. But when you do say that, that just puts the ball in another team's court to offer that offer when maybe they wouldn't. You don't really know. Obviously, a player, is he worth that sort of money? I'm not sure. Is he worth that sort of money to the Pistons? Absolutely, with this team. So, I think that's...
I think Stan Van Gundy said something along the lines of, we can't lose him, like, as a quote. Like, we can't lose him. Like, you're right. We really can't.
Yeah.
We'll be up Schitt's Creek without a paddle if we don't re-sign him at that point.
Yeah, we'll have a serious identity crisis. So, I think everybody's known that the Brooklyn Nets are likely to throw that max offer at him. But saying that we'll match anything doesn't leave us a lot of room for movement and potentially, not having to max him. I think it eases KCP's anxiety a little bit going into the offseason, which is good. But as a team as a whole, I don't really understand that strategy. That being said, do I want us to sign him to any sheet that is offered to him? Yes, absolutely.
Completely agreed. It's just something, like we said, I don't know, especially when you look at the starting shooting guard position in the league right now. It's probably the weakest position in the league when you look at quality players in depth. It's pretty low on the top end, and it's very low on, you know, when you go into the depth sort of, you know, looking at teams' full roster. So especially when you look at the Detroit Pistons roster, we've had a major issue with the backup shooting guard for seasons now. You know, you look at guys like on the current roster right now, Darren Hilliard. You look at guys like, you know, Reggie Bullock on the roster right now, going back into the years of Rodney Stuckey and Ben Gordon. It's been a pretty inconsistent spot ever since Richard Hamilton has left this team, or at least when he was a productive member of the team. So, yeah, you kind of can't lose a guy that is reaching his prime, extremely young, your best on-the-ball defender, and has shown bright spots of being your best three-point shooter. Although he wasn't statistically our best three-point shooter this year, he was for a major stretch of the season. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, we've been in the pay KCP bandwagon. Not a bandwagon. We've just been on pay KCP Island, along with a lot of other writers and whatnot, for quite some time. I think the fans are some of the most against the deal, right? Is that what you've noticed, Joe, when it comes to like social media figures, yeah, or sites and whatnot?
I think a lot of people view him as very streaky and inconsistent, like you said, and he has been that at times. But also the two strengths that he possesses are two things that are sort of lacking on this squad, one of those being defense and effort and intensity. I'll group those all together. And the other one being shooting. Clearly, when he came back from injury, he didn't shoot as well, but he knocked down a lot of big threes for us early on in the season and later on as well. So we need both of those elements of his game, and if we lose those, then we'll have a pretty serious identity crisis. So, yeah, please max KCP. The other one, Aaron Baines, again, everyone assumed that he was going to walk. He did have a semi-cryptic comment saying that he had some unfinished business with the Pistons. Do you think there's any substance to that at all?
Frankly, no. So I guess the question is for you know, maybe general NBA fans, you're probably not too worried or concerned about what Aaron Baines' player option looks like. But it's a $6.5 million deal that he can either elect into for this upcoming season, or he can decline that portion of the deal and become an unrestricted free agent. Thus, you know, any team can offer him any amount of money. So, I see the market still being hot when it comes to just free agents in general this season, this upcoming off season. So I don't necessarily see him opting into that $6.5 million deal. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that he won't re-sign with Detroit on a 2-year $18 million deal or something like that, where he still might be under what he would be offered from opposing teams. But at the same time, it's still going to be more than his $6.5 million deal that he's could elect into right now. So I don't see him electing into that deal. I could see an avenue, I guess, where the Pistons offer a little bit more money than that $6.5 million slot in order to bring him back and kind of have that go-to backup center that we've had over the past few years.
Yeah, I think he's more or less gone at this point. I think that's just kind of a public professional comment coming from his direction. He's a very professional a player that shows a lot of leadership. So I think that's just him sort of giving that image to other teams. But I definitely do not see us re-signing him, especially with an ample third-string center who's very willing and ready to move into that backup center position. And I think a lot of Pistons fans are ready for that. As much as we've loved what Aaron Baines has done for this team, I just think it's time to move on for both parties. And I think he's going to get a bigger deal. And I think he will happily part on a good means with the Pistons, and same for us as well. So, you know, good for him for saying that. And it was a good run, but I think he's going elsewhere for more money.
Yeah, I do too. And you can't blame him. You know what? He's been on championship teams with the Spurs. He's been on kind of rough and rugged, kind of figure it out sort of teams like the Pistons. He can really go wherever he wants and be pretty happy. And if the dollar signs are what's going to make him ultimately happy, I can't blame him for that. And I would do the same thing. I would probably be going where the most money was, as long as it wasn't, you know, a disaster of an organization like the Knicks or something.
Yeah,
like
and he's 30, so it's not like he's gonna get another massive contract after the next contract that he gets. So I think the time is right, and I think it's a smart a personal decision for him to move on. But I don't think it's anything that's gonna set the Pistons back too much.
Sure, completely agree. Well, that kind of brings us to our next topic. We're talking about, you know, obviously what the future holds, and you know, some things that are going on in Detroit Pistons land. And I think the main thing that's going to be on everybody's mind, at least if you're local to the state of Michigan, is the move downtown to downtown Detroit. Just to set the stage a little bit there, the Pistons have played in the Palace of Auburn Hills for years, for 30 plus years or so, possibly even longer, maybe 40 years. But either way, they've been in that building up in Auburn Hills. Now, if you're not from Michigan, which I'm sure, you know, some of these listeners are not, Auburn Hills is what, Joe, like 45, 50 minutes away from Detroit, at least when you're, you know, putting into play traffic as well.
Yeah, it's a serious hike. It's not just a 15-minute drive outside of the city. It's upwards of 30 to 40 minutes, and there's not a lot of I don't know, culture, places to go to around the stadium itself. So
that is literally the kindest thing you could say about Auburn Hills, Michigan.
Yeah.
All right. So here, let me just paint a picture. If you're driving through some town and you see, you know, seven buildings that are roughly anywhere from three stories to seven stories, and they're all like these like desolate, really, you know, standardized looking business complexes. That is what Auburn Hills is. There's no nightlife. There's nothing out there except an arena and some office spaces. So it's. To me, it's one of the more depressing places in Michigan.
Yeah, it's,
and I'm
sorry, it's
almost, am I defensive?
It's almost like the Field of Dreams Stadium in the middle of nowhere, cornfields in the middle of Iowa. There's just nothing else.
Yeah.
So huge move. We're very excited about it, and the city of Detroit's excited as well. So that means that this team needs to get their act together, and you know, we need maybe a little bit of a mental makeover. We'll see what happens. But touching on that, David, a little bit, I know you went to some games at the Palace. I think some playoff games, correct?
I have. I've been to a couple.
Any memories that stand out there for you?
Yeah, I would say, so there's two memories that actually, I would say three. And what do you want to do? Do you want to kind of play hot potato with this one, or do you want me to just kind of name them all?
Yeah, I think you just throw them out there. I don't think I have anything as substantial as what you have, so.
All right. Well, I think going back, and this might be in chronological order, actually, I was at LeBron James' first game at the Palace of Auburn Hills, in which the Detroit Pistons held LeBron James while he was in his first season with the Cleveland Cavaliers, to a whopping total of 8 points. The Palace was rocking. Everyone was excited for King James. But, you know, he was a rookie and he was going against a team that was, you know, kind of cementing themselves in the playoffs and were going to be in the playoffs for years to come. He had Ricky Davis as a team member. And then a lot of other just kind of bad fringe players. So, you know, that was pretty cool, although the game itself wasn't super exciting. Another memory was, I believe this was the 2002-2003 playoffs, round one versus the Orlando Magic. And this is kind of going back there now. Now we're going back 14 years.
That's a memorable series,
though. It was. So, just in case people don't remember what that series looked like, the Pistons were, so it was, this was game two. The Pistons lost game one. And I believe this was either one seed versus 8 seed Detroit Pistons. No, Detroit was probably, I think, like the 2 seed or 3 seed at that time. But it was a much higher ranked Detroit team compared to pretty much just Tracy McGrady and whatever else was on that Orlando Magic team, which wasn't much. If you do remember, Detroit went down 3-1, and it looked like Orlando was going to be marching on. And in that fourth game, or after that fourth game, once the Magic had taken over,
Pistons were one, Magic were eight.
Oh, Pistons were one, Magic were eight. Okay, yeah, I thought it was 1-8. And so Tracy McGrady, you know, they're up 3-1. He says it finally feels good to be moving on to the second round. Before actually moving on to the second round. So, of those first four games, Detroit only won one of them. I was at the game which they won. It was beautiful Palace of Auburn Hills basketball. It was beautiful, you know, playoff atmosphere in the city, you know, just north of Detroit. So, that was an awesome game and one that I'll definitely never forget.
Not to cut you off, but that was the Tayshaun Prince coming out party. Was that serious when T-Mac was going off in the first couple of games, then he ended up locking him down. And then the Pistons became only the 7th team in NBA history to overcome a 3-1 deficit. It kind of launched this team to another level in a way, kind of, I don't know, solidified us as a group. Then obviously got
as a contender, yeah, for
then
sure.
Obviously got Sheed the next year, and the rest is history.
Wait, do you remember what was said to Tracy McGrady regarding Tayshaun Prince's play on him, like on Tayshaun defending Tracy?
I don't. What was the quote?
So it was something along the lines of, you know, they've dubbed Tayshaun Prince they dubbed Tayshaun Prince the Tracy McGrady stopper. It's like, what are your thoughts on that, Tracy? And Tracy said something along the lines of, ain't no one a Tracy McGrady stopper. Like, there is no one in this league that's a Tracy McGrady stopper.
Which wasn't
stopper,
false
so watch
statement.
Your mouth. No, it wasn't a false statement. There is no Tracy McGrady stopper when Tracy McGrady was in his prime. It was T-Mac, man. Come on.
Yeah. But Prince was a rookie that year, too. And that was kind of a part of the... the little rivalry that they had going on that series, but yeah. What was your third memory?
Third memory, and this was, I think, the year after that. Let me just make sure I have the correct season.
The next year.
This was the 2004, I believe. This was the 2003-2004 team.
That's the year we won the chip.
It was you're right. It was the year before that. It was the 2002-2003 season. So it was actually later in that playoff run. I don't know. This was a major shot. This is one of the most historic shots in that ever fell at the Palace. But Pistons down by 3. I think there's, you know, 10 or 11 seconds left. Chauncey Billups, Mr. Big Shot, pulls up and doesn't heave the ball from half court, but does like a, he just crosses over the half court line, stops, pops, bank 3 to send the game into overtime. The Palace went bananas. Like, it was one of the craziest finishes to a game. It wasn't necessarily finished, but it sent the game to overtime that I've ever seen. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember where I was when he made that shot.
I assume going crazy. Yeah. The 2004 playoffs, of course.
Yeah, great games. Yeah, I didn't go to any iconic Pistons games. I just went, you know, I have memories just going to games in the Palace. Just in general, you know, I think a big takeaway is just those going to work days. Obviously when you and I were 12, 13 years old and rooting on the Pistons, you know, that's when Mason became our announcer, right around those times. You know, the fire above the hoops in the pregame warmups, just everything like that. I don't know what they're going to carry over. Obviously, we're going to keep Mason, but the overall...
I mean, also Europe, the Europe intro, the final countdown.
Yeah, you saying Europe was... just gave me Darko Milicic images in my head. I didn't know if that's what you were alluding to, but I do remember Darko
no,
as well.
No, don't... You can bottle up those feelings. Okay, those don't need to
I'll keep those down.
You definitely don't need to be airing those right now in this particular episode. But we can revisit those maybe over some whiskey or something. But no, you're completely right. I mean, it was an electric atmosphere, especially during those years. They had the longest sellout streak in the NBA, consecutive games sold out. There was, and one thing that I didn't know about the Palace, and I don't know if you heard this at all, Joe, during the, you know, the ceremonies of them closing out the Palace of Auburn Hills, was it was apparently like the first modernized stadium that really was the blueprint for all modern basketball stadiums and arenas across the country. And it's still held up as better than stadiums that were built after it.
Yeah.
And that was kind of pretty cool to hear too.
Yeah, I mean, it was built as a sports entertainment venue, and it was one of the first of its kind. I know it was one of the first, if not the first stadium to have luxury boxes. So obviously that's a blueprint that a lot of other stadiums have copied. And, you know, even if you go to the stadium today, it's not in bad shape. And
no, it's really not. Yeah. No, I mean, I think the move isn't, obviously, it's not because of the stadium. It's not because, you know, they're having issues with attendance or anything like that. The move for the stadium was because the timing was right. The Red Wings, the Detroit Red Wings already had this deal to, you know, open up the Little Caesars Arena in downtown Detroit and kind of, you know, cement themselves as, you know, the third team in that stadium district right downtown. And especially with the amount of teams in the league right now where hockey teams and professional basketball teams share arenas, that type of sort of coordination isn't something that you have to come up with on your own. It's something where you can borrow blueprints from other organizations and kind of really cement what that looks like contractually. And, you know, you could really explain the benefits of, hell, the Detroit Pistons are going to be in Detroit for the first time in a lot of people's lives. And especially with the boom centered around downtown Detroit, the amount of people that are moving into Detroit, I mean, the timing was perfect. And it was kind of like, if you didn't strike now, what were you going to be saying to yourself years down the road when you might possibly have to open up your own arena or something of that nature?
Yeah, and obviously we're a young and up-and-coming team, and Tom Gores is a Michigan guy, so he has a lot of love and respect for Michigan and Detroit in general. So, you know, I think it's good for the franchise and good for the city, and he recognized that. And, you know, I think that our attendance did fall for a couple years there. I think that,
and you cannot blame the fans on that
one. No, not at all. No. Well, it was the product, and like you said, it was the logistics of the stadium. The product was bad. You know, the days when Rodney Stuckey and you know, Tayshaun and some of the other guys were forming a mutiny against John Kuster were not very bright days, and nobody wanted to go to games at that time. So. Completely understandable.
I just had a small night terror when you just said John Kuster. Like,
I wonder what he's doing these days, honestly.
I know what he's doing. You know what he's doing.
Is he sitting on his couch drinking whiskey?
Yes. Okay. Ding, 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 ding.
Nice.
No, but one thing I just wanted to add, and just about the stadium, and one thing that I'm pretty excited about is, you know, it'll be nice, and one of the more difficult parts of the Palace of Auburn Hills was the traffic. Crazy, crazy traffic. It took you like an hour to even leave the parking lot just because it would just be a flood to like one or two main roads. It'll be nice now for, you know, at least people that are in, you know, that are going to bars or, you know, walking around enjoying the sights of, you know, downtown Detroit. You can just kind of walk on over to the stadium, and it's not something where you have to plan your whole night around of how am I going to get there? How am I going to get back? It's like there's plenty to do there during the day. There's plenty of options for the night, and it's just a lot easier. And I think it's going to be a bright spot for the Pistons organization moving forward.
Absolutely. Very much agreed.
Yeah.
Should we take this into the NBA land outside of the Pistons here real quick?
Where are we going? We're going to the serious basketball?
Let's keep this in Pistons land. Should we answer some questions?
Yeah, let's do it. So you want to hit them with Ask ITC.
Ask ITC. Cool. So yeah, if anyone wants to send any questions our way, our Twitter handle is Inside the Cylinder. That's Inside the CYLNDR. Because Twitter does limit the amount of characters that you can have. So yeah, we have an open forum of hashtag ITC. Got a
hashtag Ask ITC.
Excuse me. We will check. We should check hashtag ITC in the future just to make sure.
There's not like rogue questions going to like a financial firm or something like that.
Yeah, just to make sure. Got some good questions this week. The first one does identify a topic that we touched on a little bit earlier. The question is from hashtag Mr. Cadigan. David, Boban or Baines? Free agent targets.
So Boban or Baines, I don't necessarily understand the second part of the free agent targets, but Boban or Baines, I mean, come on. Like, I don't know. Baines was so good for the remainder of that year. I think it was kind of a shame that we didn't get him in more sporadic situations and in earlier games, especially when Detroit, one of the worst offensive teams in the league, I think ranked somewhere like 27th or 28th in the league this season on the offensive side of the ball. When you have a statistical force like Boban Marjanovic on your team, yeah, he probably should have seen the floor a little bit more. But when it comes to a holistic game, I think Baines is the better of the two options. But I also am not necessarily fearful that we're going to be going with probably Boban as our primary backup next season. What say you, Joe?
I just think it's time to move on from Baines. I think it's clear, and I think we need to accept it to a certain extent. From the defensive side of the ball, I'd rather have Baines out there. On the offensive side of the ball, I'd rather have Boban just based on his numbers, his ability to shoot free throws. He is a guy that the other team does have to game plan for because he can put up a lot of points in a short period of time. So I think the ability to change things on the offensive side of the ball, I'm definitely going Boban. I'm ready to accept the fact that he's our new backup center. And I think that he is a very willing and able to learn and adjust on either end of the floor. And I'm excited to see what he's going to bring to the table and how our team's going to change with him out on the floor. So definitely Boban for sure. Although it will be sad to see Baines go. Those hard screens, I'll miss him.
That's fair. That's definitely fair. I guess the second question was, it's a question of free agent targets. Who are the free agent targets for the Pistons next season? Honestly, the land of financial capability of the Detroit Pistons right now is not very strong. So when you're looking at free agent targets, you know, there's guys out there that, you know, like Bojan Bogdanovic of the Washington Wizards, just a three-point stroker. You know, he's gonna get some serious dollars coming into next season. He is a restricted free agent, but at the same time, you know, a possibility, but not for the Pistons, unfortunately. Honestly, I could see a guy like Ersan Ilyasova coming back to this team.
Oh wow,
he's an unrestricted free agent and he does provide a lot when it comes to spacing, although at the same time, it might be difficult because he plays a position where we're kind of set at the power forward slot. So I guess another individual that I was looking at that could be a possible fit, just because the dollars might make sense, would be like a Michael Beasley, a guy that's been in and out of the league left and right. He has, you know, spent time in China. He's spent time just with a ton of different organizations. He never really reached his potential, but he's shown a lot of good things, especially for that Milwaukee Bucks team. So, you know, I think that that's a certain, you know, type of profile of a guy where Detroit definitely needs a guy of his potential on the offensive side of the ball. He's not too bad on the defensive side of the ball either, and we might be able to get him at like a right price. So that's what I would say would be like a Michael Beasley type, and maybe Michael Beasley himself.
So shooters or veterans for the vet minimum or something around there, pretty much.
Exactly. Yeah. And also, I think Marcus Morris needs somebody to go to the club with.
That's very true. Marcus, you can't be going to the club with Henry Ellenson anymore. It's just not – it's not good for his reputation.
That they're moved downtown Detroit, he's not going to the same clubs anymore.
With Ellenson. No, I agree. If we do sign someone, I think he's either going to be a shooter or a veteran for on the cheap. That being said, I don't think that's a huge need for this team. I think really – free agency, we just need to re-sign KCP and maybe a shooter or a young guy who can develop in the D League. I don't really know, but not any player that's going to get any serious playing time in the rotation next year, because we're already having playing time or rotation issues.
Here's another guy, Joe. Let me just say a name. And honestly, I just had noticed now that he is an unrestricted free agent thanks to the lovely work over at DetroitBadBoys.com. Gerald Green from the Boston Celtics. He is a guy that he kind of punches in bunches. He's kind of guy that can score like 14 points in a very short amount of time. He can hit the three. He can jump out of the gym. And he can play that backup two spot shooting guard, where Detroit's been one of the weaker teams in the league. Clearly, because they've had this like rotation of players that just haven't been able to get the job done.
Yeah.
What do you think about a guy like Gerald Green?
That's definitely a guy that Marcus Morris could go to the club with for sure. So it would fill that void. But in terms of the rotation, yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing him as, I don't know, our 12th guy off the bench or something like that. Not getting steady minutes, but playing when we need him. Because like you said, he can shoot the three. He's athletic, he's a veteran, so I think that he would be a decent, solid addition to this team. The question and the way that you answered it in terms of signing a Beasley or Ersan Ilyasova does lead us into the next question by Mr. Cadigan. Next question was, what do we do with the bevy of fours that we have already? That being Tobias Harris, John Luer, and Henry Ellenson. Henry Ellenson's young. It's going to be his second year. Is he going to be able to find some playing time? And how do we work that out exactly?
So what do we do with the bevy of fours? Man, that's a question that we've been asking ourselves all season when it comes to that power forward slot. It's honestly, for some of our older listeners, it's probably they might be getting triggered right now in the sense of, are we going down the Tobias Harris, John Luer wormhole again? But I'm sad to say, but we kind of are.
Sam Gunny might be chain smoking cigarettes just thinking about it right now.
No, Stan Van Gundy is definitely chain smoking. What cigarettes does Stan Van Gundy smoke?
L&M's? I don't know.
Ooh, nah, he's like a Marlboro Red kind of guy. That mustache demands Marlboro Reds, Cowboy Killers.
Good job.
Anyways, so the bevy of fours, I mean, my first answer would be start Tobias Harris at all cost. He's possibly your best player on the team. So that's where you start, and you start with starting him. Secondly, John Luer off the bench and hope that he's not a corpse like he was for the past, you know, 3 months of the season. From there, work in Henry Ellenson into some playing time. I think we talked about this maybe on the last episode or possibly the episode before that. It's something along the lines of, you know, you want him to start develop. You want him to start seeing the floor, defending NBA bodies, you know, 5 to 10 minutes a game. I would like to see that. But that's where it goes. I think that's all you have to say about that position.
Yeah, I agree. I think the main thing with the fours is for Stan Van Gundy to learn from his mistake this year and just to have a set lineup and just to go with it at the beginning of the year. And Tobias Harris knows what his role is. John Luer knows what his role is. Ellenson knows that he might get some some prime playing time. It's not always going to be the last two or three minutes of a blowout game. And if the players know that, I think that puts them in the right state of mind in order to make that impact and not be confused in terms of where they're going to be playing their matchups on a day-to-day night. So I think that's the main thing. But I do agree. I think Henry Ellenson does need to get a little bit more playing time.
Wait, quick question on your answer. You're saying that the main thing is figuring out just having a set lineup. Would you be happy if John Lohr was the if as long as it's set, but John Lohr's the starting power forward and Tobias Harris is coming off of the bench? Would you be happy with that, or you're saying I want a set lineup which features Tobias Harris as a starter, no question?
Yeah, I want a starting lineup which features our best power forward, who is Tobias Harris. So I'd be pretty upset if that ended up being John Lohr for whatever reason, you know, it may be. I just don't really believe in starting a player who isn't your best player at that position. I would definitely want Tobias Harris as our starting power forward, and I think that will probably happen.
I think this season we've come to realize that John Lohr isn't a starting power forward in this league, period.
He's a great backup power forward. He's not a good starting power forward. And there's a very I think the same thing about Ish Smith. I mean, there's a very clear distinction between the two, and you can see it on the floor.
Completely agree. No, I mean, I completely agree. It's the eye test says everything that you need to see. Like, really, it kind of cements the whole concept of this argument, and it's that Tobias Harris is clearly the better player. So let's move on from that one on to the next question. This one is from AJ Richards at @A_J_Richards 222. Thank you, AJ, for the question. Appreciate it. Did the Pistons underachieve this year or overachieve last year? Related, if they underachieved this year, how much of the blame lies on Stan Van Gundy? Go ahead, Joe.
I don't think they overachieved last year. I think they played... I think the product reflected the talent, honestly. And I think our final record and the fact that we made it to the first round of the playoffs and we competed with the Cavs, and although we got swept, we competed. I think that was pretty transparent in terms of who we were as a team. This year, I think we definitely underachieved. A lot of people expected a seed in the playoffs for starters, and a high seed in the playoffs, and potentially a second round visit. So I think definitely underachieved this year. I blame a lot on Sam Van Gundy. He can't predict Reggie Jackson's injury, but he can manipulate what happens with Reggie Jackson on the floor when he does come back from injury. And I didn't think he did that well. And I think the fact that our lineups were in flux the entire season just threw everything off, and we never really got 2 feet on the ground. So I think because of that, a lot of the blame should go on Stan Van Gundy.
If you were to give it a percentage, like, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60, like, what percentage would you give? I know that's kind of hot takey, but let me hear it. What do you
got? Yeah, it's tough because obviously the players are the ones who perform and play the game. So I would give him 60% and 40% to the players, because he is the one that is responsible for putting them in the right position to win games. And I just didn't think that he did that.
Here's this little side question, I guess. And I feel like you and I are very like-minded in that sort of belief. I think 60% sounds a little high. I one thing that I would note is that a lot of... I don't know. I'll get back to that point. But do you think that... I feel like people of our generation, you know, the millennial types and, you know, people in their 20s or early 30s and whatnot, they have this sort of sense where they're player first, like way, way player first, where I feel like people maybe from a bit older of a generation might be, you know, saying like, well, these guys aren't even trying out there on the floor. Like, when you look at social media and people on Twitter and Facebook lambasting the team, it is always going at the players and directly at the players and in the players' mentions on their Twitter. So I think that there's sort of a I don't know if it's a generational sort of thing, or I don't know. Any thoughts on that? But I feel like people like us and always want to blame the coaches.
Yeah, I mean, that may be a part of it. I think the other thing is when you give a... So Stan Van Gundy has had a lot of success in this league, and it's rare for a team like the Pistons to pull a coach with his winning percentage and resume to Detroit. So I think a part of it is people just being happy that he came and wanting people to desire Detroit as a destination in the future. Sort of keeping in mind, well, what is our second best option? John Kuster? Like, you know, we're happy with what we got. To
Michael Curry?
To a degree. Yeah, Michael Curry, like Lawrence Frank. I don't know, you know. So I think there's a couple different things going on. But I think at the end of the day, really, after 3 years with the up and down season that we have, you can't help but place a lot of blame on Stan Van Gundy. And I think a lot of people, as time winds down, it all comes full circle, and it falls on the head leader of the team.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I pretty much disagree completely with you. I would say it's probably a 50-50 the way you would cut the pie. I think they definitely underachieved this year. I don't think they overachieved last year. I pretty much would just echo exactly what you're saying. So now for our last question in hashtag AskITC, please hit us up with your questions. You can find us on Twitter at Inside the Cylinder. That's CYLNDR. But our last question, friend of the pod, at Superflight Pod, also a member of the Almighty Baller Radio Network, Joe Borelli, he asked us, should we form a search party for Stanley Johnson? And is therapy Reggie Jackson's number one offseason priority? I'll take this one real quick. Please. Search party? Yeah, I mean, I think Stanley Johnson needs like a little bit of a sit me down, almost, in a certain sense of, things just did not go well. He did not have a great relationship. Honestly, not a sit me down. I think that he has to sit down with Stan Van Gundy, and they need to iron some stuff out, because he is far too talented to be riding the pine and having DNPCD or did not play coach's decision. These types of things can't happen when you were the number 8 overall pick, and essentially the build of our starting or the Detroit Pistons starting small forward for years to come. And that needs to be figured out. So I think the answer for both of these questions is yes, therapy. I think Reggie Jackson, honestly, I think Stanley Johnson and Stan Van Gundy need to sit down and have a little powwow and have a therapist there so they can work some stuff out, because I can't imagine it all being on Stan Van Gundy, and I can't imagine it all being on Stanley Johnson, but there's something there, and it sucks because he's too good of a player for riding the pine.
Yeah, next year's going to be year 3, too. So it's at some point in time, you do become a veteran, and that's, I don't know, year 4 or 5. And although he's young, after year 3, that's really when you kind of see flashes of what a player can be. And although we've seen tiny tidbits of that, it hasn't been in a large enough sample that we can feel completely optimistic about what we have with him in the near future. And, although, yes, him and Stan Van Gundy do need a powwow, but when Stanley Johnson gets shots in a game, he needs to make them at the same time. He did have a lack of opportunities, but in the opportunities that he did have, the shooting wasn't there, for one. So I think that he needs to figure that out, and, both of them need to, sit down and go back and forth. And Reggie Jackson.
And maybe
Reggie Jackson might need to be involved in that session as well. I don't know.
I think Reggie Jackson really needs to actually. I don't know if that was like a tongue in cheek type of question from at Superflight Pod, but I think that's a real answer. Like, I think, yes, I think he does need some sort of counseling. His confidence was shot. These athletes deal with so much, and player psychology is a lucrative business, but a real one at the same time. And I believe in the profession. I believe in the professionals that would be kind of operating and managing that type of scenario, especially with Reggie Jackson, who was If you're new to the Detroit Pistons, he was a fringe all-star last season, 18 points per game, about 8 assists per game or 7 assists per game. The Detroit Pistons' best player, at least offensively speaking. And this season, he was a ghost and was battling injury all year. So it was a really bad situation, and it only turned worse as the season continued and continued and continued. So I think that he certainly needs to talk it out and, you know, get some emotions out there and maybe have a good cry.
A good cry, yeah. I think that'd be good for him. So he needs some mental therapy and some physical therapy. We already know that, though. But, no, I'm definitely with you there.
I wonder if you meant physical therapy.
What's that?
All right, yeah, let's keep it moving because we want to talk some NBA stuff.
Yeah, let's say you've been watching the playoffs much.
Was at the Boston Celtics-Chicago Bulls game last night. So got a first-hand sneak peek into real playoff basketball. It was pretty awesome, Joe. I loved playoff basketball.
For the record here, I am geographically located in Chicago. David is geographically located in Boston. We're both Michigan guys, though. We both went to Central Michigan University. But, you know, our Pistons and Detroit fans still. Bulls fans are pretty excited about that. Didn't see much of a product going into the playoffs, but they do have the best player in that series, and Boston is a pretty soft one. I will say that much.
Boston has it's really hard to kind of comment on this with everything that's happened with, you know, the death of Isaiah Thomas's sister, and you could see, especially in this game, I think in game one with Isaiah Thomas, he was able to sort of emotionally channel all of that type of, I don't even know what he could be going through, honestly, but I think he was able to kind of channel that into, you know, 33 points and, you know, really looking like the MVP candidate that he has been all season. I think game two of that game really kind of showed the vulnerability of emotionally dealing with something like that. And he didn't look good. He was getting just housed on defense. They were sending 2-3 guys at him. He kept on getting caught in the air and just forcing bad passes and turnovers. The Boston Celtics were getting bodied on the rebounds. You know, players like Zipser was hitting crucial buckets. Mirotić had a sighting. Rajon Rondo almost put up a triple-double. I mean, if it could have gone bad for the Boston Celtics, it did go bad. And I think that that's kind of I think that's a wrap. I think Chicago's moving on. I think they're taking out the one seed, and that is crazy.
That is crazy, especially considering the fact that it could have potentially been the Pistons in the eighth seed, and it does make you think a little bit. We don't really want to go down that wormhole because it's difficult to deal with. But hypothetically speaking, if the Pistons were the eighth seed, they could be potentially competing with these Celtics, because we did the same with the Bulls, and our roster is just as competitive as the Bulls. So I'll leave it at that. But
and we give them the same issues. We would body them on rebounds, and that would be something that is tantalizing at the least. Andre Drummond feasted against the Boston Celtics this past season, averaged around 18 and 17, 18 points, 17 rebounds. So the Boston Celtics didn't want anything to do with the Detroit Pistons, but, you know, what if, right?
Yeah.
Moving on. Next series, I want to ask you a question about, Joe. And we texted about this over the weekend. Toronto Raptors versus the Milwaukee Bucks. Giannis Antetokounmpo out here balling. Your thoughts?
Well, I want to ask you a question on that really quickly. Who's the best player in that series, in your mind?
Come on.
The best player in that series.
Not even close. Giannis.
I think that makes a big I think that's a huge difference maker in the playoffs. And just watching him glide up and down the court and muscling his way to the hole and getting these Stretch Armstrong dunks is incredible. So that, I think that's the type of player that can win one or two or a few games. Toronto's another team, in the top of the East that's a little bit soft as well. I would put, you know, Cleveland, the Wizards, they're both very physical, like aggressive teams that you have to mimic. You know, whereas the Raptors and the Celtics have a different playing style. So I think that's a really good matchup for the Bucks, and I could definitely see them coming out on top in that series.
The Raptors are one of the worst playoff teams I've ever seen. I'm just gonna say that they look like they're scared in the moment. Kyle Lowry, and I was listening to some podcasts today. Kyle Lowry is the worst statistical shooter in the playoffs history. In the history of the playoffs, he's the worst statistical shooter. So, I mean, and he's your number one guy. DeRozan's kind of your number two there. But they got some issues, man. And I don't know. At the very least, I see that going seven. But I'm going Bucks. I say Bucks.
I would say Bucks as well. Actually, no, I'm going to take that back. If I were to bet half of my bank account on that series, I would go with the Raptors. But my gut feeling is Bucks.
All right. Let's move on to another exciting one.
Yeah.
Wait, what you got?
I was going to go big picture, but I'll go to a different series.
Yeah, we got time. Let's do it. Oh, no. We can go. Hey, let's go one out west, right? Let's go to one. So what do you think about the Clippers versus the Utah Jazz? The series is all knotted up at 1-1. Rudy Gobert got injured. The Stifel Tower, one of the best defensive players in the league, got yanked after 13 seconds of play after he hyperextended his knee. So hopefully he gets back because there was no structural damage, but bone bruise and all that kind of stuff. The series is tied 1-1. A really tantalizing matchup, Joe. Any thoughts on that one?
Well, it's a shame that Gobert went down. I think the Utah Jazz are the Bucks of the West. I could see them sneaking a series from a team, especially the Clippers, because they've lost some big playoff series in their day. So that's probably one of those series, especially because they lost the Jazz lost Gobert, that if I were to bet a lot of money on it, realistically speaking, I would go with the Clippers. But my gut feeling is that the Jazz have a really good chance to win this series. I like their team a lot. They smashed on the Pistons a couple times this year. And I don't know. We'll see. Who do you got?
I got Clips. I just think that they're just, I don't know, Chris Paul, Blake Griffin, DeAndre Jordan. I like that trio. I think a lot of people do, obviously.
J.J. Redick. But
J.J. Redick, who's looked pretty awful, honestly, in the games that I've in both games that I've watched so far this year.
But he's the type of guy that could just get hot in a game and win one for you.
You're right. Yeah, you're right. He's a guy that could go 5 for 5 from three, right? So I'm not doubting that he has that skill set, but I don't know. Yeah, but I think they're just a little bit more complete of a team and a little bit more ready to win, where I still think the Jazz might be in a sort of happy to be here type of thing, where, you know, this is their first year as this squad getting into the playoffs. So, all right, Joe, let's just see here, you know, we got about 10 minutes left. MVP talk.
Real quick, before we get to that, I do want to talk big picture in the playoffs.
Oh, sure.
So the favorites going into this year, and rightfully so, were the Cavaliers and the Warriors. I think that's still pretty set in stone, although there's a couple teams out west, specifically the Rockets and the Spurs, who could shake things up a little bit. I don't really think there's any teams in the east that could shake things up. I could see the Spurs are the type of team that could beat the Cavs, but I don't think they could beat the Warriors. So we all anticipate that being the matchup. Given that's the case, who do you have as your winner?
On the record, David Fernandez picks the Golden State Warriors to win in six games.
Wow. I'll take the Warriors in seven.
I don't see it going seven, man. Just going to say it. I just think that there's too much power on that team and just too much Draymond, too much Kevin Durant, too much Klay Thompson, and just too much Steph Curry.
I remember you saying something about it not going seven last year against the Cavaliers, though. I do remember a text message thread that you didn't think it'd go seven.
Me, Zach Lowe, you know, going into Mark Stein and, you know, all of us, you know, we didn't think that it was going seven, but hey, you know, it went seven. Actually, I think Zach Lowe did pick it to go seven, but either way,
not this year.
Yeah, not this year. I don't think so. I just think the Cavaliers, I don't even I'm not even pointing that towards the fact that I think that the Warriors are head and shoulders a better team than they were last year. I'm pointing that. I just think that the Cavaliers are a much worser team than they are last year, especially on the defensive side of the ball, man. They're getting points put up on them against a really mediocre Pacers team. And people keep on talking about the Cavaliers being able to hit a switch and start playing defense and to get back on defense and to understand their assignments and to lock down on guys. I don't think it's that easy, and I think it just gets more difficult and more difficult with each series that you move on to. And you're not going to just turn it on against a team like the Warriors who punch in bunches. I'll say it again, and they will, you know, they'll score 20 points in a matter of 3 minutes, 4 minutes, and there's nothing you can do to stop that type of offense. So I just don't see it happening. Not for three games.
Completely agree. And I think it's gotten to the point where in the Cavaliers locker room, it's LeBron James sort of barking at people, and you don't want that happening in the playoffs. LeBron playing dad there in the locker room, the Warriors are just too good. I can't see it happening. They still have Iguodala and Livingston coming off the bench. The matchups are hard. Durant got some rest. He had some games out. So, no, I completely agree with you there. Leading into our last topic here, MVP talk. It's been a very hot topic this year, and for very good reason. A lot of players have been putting up eye-popping numbers that we literally haven't really seen before.
The fifth option is Isaiah Thomas, and he scored like 30 points per game.
And carried his team to the number one seed in the Eastern Conference. So,
and that's the weakest resume.
Yeah.
Like, that's insane.
So, but I think at this point in time, it's pretty clear that the number one and two option is options are Russell Westbrook and James Harden. I think we disagree a little bit on who should win this. I'm personally going with Russell Westbrook for a couple different reasons. Yeah, he did average a triple-double, but he also did carry his team to, I believe, the 4 seed, correct? Or was it the 5 seed?
They're the 6 seed. They're the 6 seed. Six they're playing seed. Against the Rockets, who are the 3 seed.
So overachieved immensely. Lost the, you know, arguably the number 3 player in the league.
I don't think Vegas says that, though, man. I think Vegas had them at, like, 47 wins, and they ended up, I think, at 48 wins. I don't think that the Thunder overachieved, to be completely honest. You know, just to kind of circle back on that, I think it's something where, you know, at least initially, teams were a little hesitant about people were hesitant about if he was going to be able to kind of keep up this triple doubles, what it meant for the quality of wins and the amount of wins. I mean, yeah, it was really impressive, but I don't necessarily think they overachieved that much, and I don't think the 6 seed is something to kind of write home about. Do you?
Yeah, I do. I don't know. I didn't know what the Vegas odds were, but I also personally do believe that his supporting cast isn't as good as James Harden. His supporting cast, and I think the system that Harden plays in is conducive to putting up high assist numbers, as well as
because of James Harden.
Well, part of that is James Harden. Part of that's the
Reggie Jackson wouldn't put up high assist numbers in that offense.
Well, they have a lot of 3-point shooters. So I mean, you know, Ryan Anderson, Eric Gordon, Lou Williams, down the line, Trevor Ariza. Like, those are all guys who are better 3-point shooters than any of the Pistons 3-point shooters. So that adds a couple assists a game.
How many people were talking about Ryan Anderson and Eric Gordon last season or 2 seasons ago as being, like, these, you know, sort of amazing supporting cast players? Like, Aaron Gordon was, like, kind of a guy where it's like, is he ever going to figure it out? Is he a guy that's kind of just never going to reach his potential?
But he did, you know, because Ryan Anderson, in that system. He's in the system
that James Harden makes.
Well, that it's Mike no D'Antoni system without James Harden. Originally made. And
but Mike D'Antoni would say himself that this team goes only as far as James Harden can take them, and that's because he's the perfect player to maximize this system. And he's done it to the tune of, you know, he led the league in assists this year at 11 a game. He was tied for second for points per game at 29.1 points per game. And he also chipped in 8.1 rebounds per game. If James Harden would have averaged 2 more rebounds per game and you know, they essentially would have you know, the 3 seed versus the 6 seed. Would you not be voting for James Harden if you had a vote?
You need 2 more points a game and 2 more, or yeah. So 2 more points per game and 2 more rebounds per game. I don't know. That'd be a different discussion. Again, a lot of this for me is based on the supporting cast, and I think that's just where we disagree, and the system as well. I don't know. I mean
that's fair. I mean, I just think that one thing that I've noticed about this argument is that people always talk about Russell Westbrook's supporting cast. If we look back to last year, and when the Oklahoma City Thunder, with Kevin Durant, mind you, obviously, had a 3-1 lead against the Golden State Warriors, people were singing the praises of Steven Adams. They were singing the praises of Enes Kanter, who was like figuring it out on defense, and it was like automatic points off the bench. They were, you know, even Roberson, who was a pretty awful shooter, was hitting some big shots and, you know, is one of the best on the ball defenders in the league. And then in the offseason, they acquire guys like Victor Oladipo, the former number 2 overall pick, and the pick for Domantas Sabonis, who is one of the more exciting rookies to come out this year. And now all of a sudden, I'm supposed to be, you know, just convinced that team is just vastly worse than a team that has Trevor Ariza, Ryan Anderson, and Montrezl Harrell. Like, those are the guys that I'm supposed to be like, yeah, that team's way better than the other team. And I'm not buying it.
That's fair. I think that the reason why both these guys are in this conversation is because, you know, none of these guys are superstars around them. So, which is why, for one, they've been able to put up these numbers. You know, they've gained so much respect for what they've been able to do. So, David, I think that about wraps it up for this episode. Do you have anything else to add?
No, I'm just saying, I think in like 2 seasons, we'll be talking about, you know, Pistons 2 seed or 3 seed and our MVPs that are going to be, you know, Andre Drummond, Reggie Jackson, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, Tobias Harris, one of those guys really cementing themselves as a premier MVP candidate. So kind of just looking forward to the steps that take us there. But no, I'm good. Inside the Cylinder, CYLNDR. Follow us on Twitter. And yeah, look forward to next week's
app. Yeah, hashtag AskITC. Hit us up with some questions, and we'll get back at you guys next week.
Peace.